the more productive you become. The amount of attentional space consumed by complex tasks varies over time. While carrying on a discussion with your boss, for example, your attentional space may shrink and expand rhythmically to match the content of the conversation, allowing your mind both to wander and to focus on the conversation when it becomes more complex. In a team meeting, you could, in an instant, go from being a passive observer to getting called on for a progress update. Having some attentional space to spare during complex tasks allows you to do two things. It leaves room to reflect on the best approach to completing the task so you can work smarter and avoid autopilot mode. You'll be able to come up with ideas you might not have had if you were filling your attention to the brim, such as the realization that you could scrap the introduction of the presentation you're going to give and instead dive directly to the point. Leaving some attention also enables you to work with a greater awareness of where you should be directing your attention in the first place. That means you can better refocus when your mind inevitably wanders from the task at hand. At the same time, you have attentional space to spare if the task suddenly becomes even more complex. Attention overload. Fitting the right amount and type of tasks into attentional space is both an art and an investment in productivity. The costs of overloading our attention can be pretty severe. Have you ever walked into your kitchen or living room and realized you've forgotten why you went there in the first place? You've fallen into an attention overload trap. You tried to cram too many things into your attentional space, the TV show that was playing in the background, random thoughts, and the IMDb page you had just read, and didn't have enough space left for your original intention. In this case, you meant to grab the grocery list your partner left on the dining room table. The same thing happens when work problems weigh on your mind as you drive home from the office. In this situation, your mind may be even more full, decoding and processing the talk show on the radio, while ruminating on what happened at work that day, while running through the multiple habit sequences that let you drive home largely on autopilot mode. If you had planned on buying bread on the way, chances are you won't have enough space to accommodate even that small, simple intention. You'll arrive home feeling overwhelmed, and only in the morning will you open the bread drawer and remember the previous day's task. We have to work with intention as much as possible. This is especially true when we have more to do than time within which to do it. Intention enables us to prioritize so we don't overload our attentional space. Doing so also leaves us feeling more calm. Just as you likely feel uncomfortable after overeating, stuffing your attentional space with too many tasks can make you feel unsettled. At any one time, your attentional space should hold at most two key things that you are processing: what you intend to accomplish and what you're currently doing. This isn't possible 100% of the time, especially as you become immersed in a task, but by being mindful of your intention, you can be confident that what you're immersed in is what you're actually aiming to get done. If you find yourself responding to important work in autopilot mode, chances are you're trying to cram too much into your attentional space. By not stepping back to deliberately manage your attention, you allow it to overflow. Some familiar examples: taking care of your toddler while shopping, trying to walk and text at the same time. Just this morning, I watched someone bump into a mailbox because they're trying to do this. Rewinding a movie, TV show, or audiobook because someone was talking to you or because you simply zoned out for a while. Adding baking soda instead of baking powder to a recipe because you're ruminating on something or watching TV. Leaving the theater with a stomach ache because you didn't have enough attention left to notice you'd eaten too much popcorn. Forgetting to put the divider on the grocery store checkout belt for the next person, like the lady in front of me forgot to do this morning as she flipped through a magazine. You've probably experienced many similar moments. Some are impossible to avoid because life often presents us with unexpected surprises. But many are possible to circumvent, and noticing that you're beginning to feel overwhelmed is a great sign that you should check in to assess what's occupying your attentional space. Chances are, you're trying to cram too much into it at once. The best way to avoid this overload is to be more selective with what you permit into your attentional space. On the drive home, shut off the radio, which will enable you to process the day and also remember your intention to pick up bread. At home, pause or mute the TV so you don't try to continue processing the show and forget that you're heading to fetch a note that's in the other room. Making small changes like these allows you to keep your attention on your intention. Simplifying our attentional space lets us maintain enough room to work and live intentionally throughout the day. This lets us spend more time on what's important and meaningful in the moment. The state of your attentional space determines the state of your life. When your attentional space is overwhelmed, you, in turn, feel overwhelmed. When your attentional space is clear, you also feel clear. The tidier you keep your attentional space, the more clearly you think. Side note, time for a quick check-in. What's occupying your attentional space at this moment? Take stock of everything that's on your mind. If you find that your attentional space is a bit too full, simplify what's in it, either by writing down these things so you can deal with them later, or by refocusing on the book you're listening to. Simplifying what we focus on in the moment may feel counterintuitive. When we have so much to get done, our natural impulse is to focus on as much as possible. Compounding this is the fact that the brain's prefrontal cortex, the large part of the forebrain that lets us plan, think logically, and get work done, has a built-in novelty bias. Whenever we switch between tasks, it rewards us with dopamine, that amazing pleasure chemical that rushes through our brain whenever we devour a medium-sized pizza, accomplish something awesome, or have a drink or two after work. You may have noticed that you instinctively reach for your tablet when you sit down to watch TV, that you can't resist keeping your email open in another window as you work, or that you feel more stimulated when your phone is by your side. Continually seeking novel stimuli makes us feel more productive. After all, we're doing more in each moment. But again, just because we're busier doesn't mean we're getting more accomplished. Almost every book in the wellness space has an obligatory section discussing how the brain is primitive and that we have to learn to rise above the impulses it gives rise to. This audiobook is no exception. An unfortunate truth is that the brain is not built to do knowledge work. It's wired for survival and reproduction. We have evolved to crave things that provide us with a surge of dopamine, which reinforces habits and behaviors that have historically aided our chances at survival. Our brain provides us with a hit of dopamine after sex as a reward for procreating. It does so when we consume sugar, which is energy dense and enables us to survive longer with less food, which was useful early in our evolution when conditions weren't as bountiful as they are today. Our brains also reward us for poorly managing our attention. Because, for our early ancestors, seeking novel threats in the environment aided their chances of survival. Instead of focusing so deeply on stoking a fire that they were not alert to a prowling tiger, early humans were constantly scanning for potential dangers around them. If that made them a bit less efficient in attending to the fire, they survived to see another day and start another fire. Today, the only nearby tigers are at the zoo, and the novelty bias that once benefited us now works actively against us. The devices we own, our TV, tablet, computer, and smartphone included, are infinitely more stimulating than the other productive and meaningful things we could be focusing on. And so with fewer predators to worry about, we naturally focus on our electronics instead. After years of researching the topic, I've found that productivity has become a bit of a loaded term. What it usually connotes is a condition that feels cold, corporate, and overly focused on efficiency. I prefer a different and friendlier definition. Productivity means accomplishing what we intend to. If our plan today is to write 3,000 words, rock a presentation with our leadership team, and catch up on our email, and we successfully accomplish all of those, we were perfectly productive. Likewise, if we intend to have a relaxing day and manage to do absolutely nothing, we're again perfectly productive. Being busy doesn't make us productive. It doesn't matter how busy we are if that busyness doesn't lead us to accomplish anything of importance. Productivity is not about cramming more into our days, but about doing the right thing in each moment. The costs add up. It bears repeating that there is nothing inherently wrong with multitasking. It's entirely possible to multitask, especially when it comes to the habitual tasks in our work and life. But it's important to make a distinction between shifting our attention and multitasking. Multitasking means concurrently trying to focus on more than one thing at a time. Shifting our attention is the movement of our attentional spotlight or our attentional space from one task to another. Shifting attention throughout the day is necessary. If we focused on just one thing all day long, no matter how important it was, we probably wouldn't have a job. Still, too much shifting can be dangerous, especially when we're surrounded by more novel objects and distractions than our brain is capable of handling. While slipping into autopilot mode is the largest cost of attention overflow, there are other disadvantages as well. For starters, letting your attentional space overflow affects your memory. You may have noticed that when you watch TV or a movie with your phone by your side, you recall much less of what you've seen. In fact, I've noticed that as I've allowed more devices into my life, I remember less in general. Technology speeds up time by tempting us in each moment to fill our attention to the brim. This leads us to remember less, because it is only when we pay attention to something that our brain actively encodes it into memory. This is why you should deliberately pay more attention to tasks you recently forgot, shutting off the oven, for example. Studying works for the same reason. By paying attention to information multiple times, you are more likely to remember it. When we make our attentional space juggle too many tasks, we fail to notice and remember the details of our most important work. When we multitask, we even process our work with an entirely different part of our brain. Take studying as an example. As Russell Poldrack, a psychology professor at Stanford, explained to me, quote, "When we learn while we multitask, we rely more heavily on the basal ganglia, a brain system that's involved in the learning of skills and habits," end quote. However, quote, "when we encode information in a more focused state, we rely more heavily on our brain's hippocampus, which actually lets us store and recall the information," end quote. What use is our time if not to create memories of conversations, meals, vacations, and other experiences? When we fail to focus deeply on any one thing, we instead only focus on the highlights of what we're doing and, as a consequence, later forget how we spent our time. Letting our attention overflow makes our actions less meaningful because we don't remember how we spent our time in the first place. This affects our productivity in the long run. We make more mistakes because we don't properly encode the lessons we learned the first time we messed up. We also accumulate less knowledge, which, when we do knowledge work for a living, sets us back in the long run. Constantly shifting our attentional spotlight to focus on one thing and then another and then another not only prevents the formation of memories, but also undermines our productivity. Research shows that the more often we fill our attention to the brim, the longer it takes to switch between tasks, the less we're able to filter out irrelevant information on the fly, and the poorer we become at suppressing the urge to switch between tasks in the first place. As I mentioned back in Chapter 0, when we're working in front of a computer, a device that's obviously chock full of novel things to focus on average, we work for just 40 seconds before we're either interrupted or distracted, in other words, interrupt ourselves. This number becomes even more concerning when you consider the fact that her phone is by her side and interrupting us as well. Needless to say, our best work happens beyond this 40-second mark. Nearly every single important task takes more than 40 seconds of focused attention to do well. Another study looked at how often 50 people switched between tasks and examined the average focus duration of the 10 most and least distracted participants. The most distracted multitaskers switched between tasks every 29 seconds, and the least distracted participants switched between tasks every 75 seconds. In other words, the most focused participants barely worked for a minute before becoming distracted. Side note, I've devoted an entire chapter later in the audiobook to dealing with these distractions and interruptions. But here's a quick tip. One of the best things you can do for your productivity is launch the settings app on your phone and scroll through the notification settings for each app. Shut off all the ones that aren't absolutely necessary. Do the same on your computer and tablet if you frequently find your focus derailed as you use these devices. Which interruptions are truly important, and which are preventing you from getting past this 40-second mark? Most of them aren't worth it. This is why I've deleted email on my phone entirely. On top of the obvious productivity toll of continually interrupting ourselves, we're also not that good at shifting our attention. Even when our attentional space is relatively clear and focused on just one task, there are deep costs associated with switching quickly to another. According to Sophie Leroy, a professor of organizational behavior at the University of Washington, it's not possible for us to seamlessly switch attention from one task to another. Leroy coined the term attention residue to describe the fragments of the previous task that remain in our attentional space after we shift to another activity. Quote, it could be that you're sitting in a meeting and your mind keeps going to a project you are working on right before the meeting, or something you anticipate doing right after the meeting. It's having that divided attention, where part of your brain is thinking about those other ongoing projects that you have. This is what makes it so difficult to devote yourself to what you're supposed to be doing in the present. End quote. This attention residue keeps our mind continuing to evaluate, problem solve, reflect, and ruminate about a previous task long after we've transitioned to the next. Switching becomes easier only once we finish a task, especially when time pressure, like a deadline, motivates us to get the task done. Quote, by contrast, end quote, Leroy explains, quote, if you work on something that you don't really have to rush, but you get it done, your brain can keep thinking about, what else should I have done? Or, is there another way to do this task, or maybe I could have done better? Even though the task is completed, it's hard for your brain to get closure in general. End quote. Since our brain is no longer motivated to complete these loose deadline tasks, Leroy found that, quote, the mental activation of the goal diminishes. End quote. Time pressure narrows our focus on the task, restricting us from considering a number of more creative ways to complete it. We don't question our approach as much because we haven't stepped back to consider the alternatives. This makes it easier to switch. All this raises a question. Just how severe is the productivity cost of switching? Switching does make your work more stimulated, and its cost may be worth bearing if your work takes only 5% longer and you make only the occasional mistake. In practice, though, the cost is usually much greater. One study found that when we continually switch between tasks, our work takes 50% longer compared with doing one task from start to completion. If you're working on a pressure or deadline-free project, consider taking a break before starting something else so more of that attention residue can dissipate. As far as your productivity is concerned, the best time to take a break is after you've finished with a big task. The quality of your attention. Intention is the bouncer of your attentional space. It lets in the productive objects of attention and keeps the distractions out. Few things will benefit your overall quality of life more than focusing with intention. It isn't possible to work and live with intention 100% of the time. Demands get in the way, our focus shifts, and our attentional space overflows. But we can maintain our intention for enough of the day to accomplish a lot more than we would otherwise. This chapter has been largely theoretical. In order to put its advice into practice, you'll need to learn to do several things. Set intentions more often. Modify your environment to be less distracting. Overcome the mental resistance you have to certain tasks. Eliminate distractions before they derail you. And clear the distractions inside your own head. The subsequent chapters cover each of these ideas in turn, but understanding the principles behind them is essential. Choosing where your attention is focused and maintaining a clear attentional space accomplishes several things at once. You will accomplish what you intend to more often. Focus more deeply because you become a better defender of your attentional space. Remember more because you're able to more deeply process what you're doing. Experience less guilt and doubt, knowing you've worked with intention. Waste less time on unimportant things. Fall victim to fewer distractions, both external and internal. Experience greater mental clarity, reduced stress, and fewer feelings of being overwhelmed. Feel a stronger purpose behind your work, because you've chosen what's worthy of your attention. Working with intention also prevents you from experiencing feelings of dullness, which stem from having a lack of purpose. And develop deeper relationships and friendships as you spend more attention, not just time, with people. There are numerous ways to measure the quality of your attention, but I've developed three measures to track my own progress. You can use these yardsticks to measure your progress as you adopt the tactics in this audiobook into your life. 1. How much of your time you spend intentionally. 2. How long you can hold your focus for in one sitting. 3. How long your mind wanders before you catch it. Now, it's time to get tactical. Chapter 3. The power of hyperfocus. Introducing hyperfocus. Think back to your last uber productive workday, one where you accomplished a huge amount. On that day, chances are a number of things were true. For starters, you were probably focused on only one thing, maybe out of necessity, driven by a deadline. This one task filled your attentional space. You were also likely able to dodge distractions and quickly got back on track every time an interruption did come up. While you were working with intense focus, you weren't working frantically, constantly switching between tasks. When your attention wandered, which it still did often, but less than usual, you quickly brought it back to the task at hand. Your work was probably also at a comfortable level of difficulty. Not so hard as to be intimidating. Not so easy that it could be done out of habit. Because of this, you may have even become completely engrossed in your work, entering a flow state where each time you looked at the clock, another hour had flown by, even though you experienced that time as only 15 minutes. Miraculously, you managed to accomplish the equivalent of several hours of work in each of them. Finally, once you overcame the hurdle of getting started, you experienced little resistance to continuing. Even though you were working hard, you weren't exhausted afterward. Curiously, you were less tired than after slower workdays. Your motivation remained strong, even if you had to stop working because you got hungry, or had a meeting, or it was time to head home. On this day, you activated your brain's most powerful mode, hyperfocus. A footnote on this. This term originates in ADHD literature and describes the phenomenon when a single task consumes one's full attention, whether or not that task is important. It's not that those with ADHD can't focus. it's that it's more difficult for them to control when they do. I've adapted the term to have a similar meaning. Intense focus, but coupled with deliberate attention. It doesn't matter how deeply you focus if what you're focusing on is not important. When you hyperfocus on a task, you expand one task, project, or other object of attention so it fills your attentional space completely. You enter this mode by managing your attention deliberately and purposefully. By choosing one object of attention, eliminating distractions that will inevitably arise as you work, and then focusing on just that one task. Hyperfocus is many things at once. It's deliberate, undistracted, and quick to refocus, and it leads us to become completely immersed in our work. It also makes us immensely happy. Recall how energized you were by your work the last time you found yourself in this state. In hyperfocus, you might even feel more relaxed than you usually are when you work. Allowing one task or project to consume your full attentional space means this state doesn't make you feel stressed or overworked. Your attentional space doesn't overflow, and your work doesn't feel nearly as chaotic. Since hyperfocus is so much more productive, you can slow down a bit and still accomplish an incredible amount in a short period of time. This mode may feel like an elusive luxury in the on-the-go environments in which we work and live today. But nothing could be further from the truth. Hyperfocus means you're less busy because you're permitting fewer objects into your attentional space. Picking which tasks to work on ahead of time lets you focus on what's actually important in the moment. This has never been more crucial than in our knowledge work environments where not all tasks are created equal. You'll often accomplish more in 1 hour of hyperfocus than in an entire day spent filling your attentional space to the brim with multiple and often undeliberate concerns. This is counterintuitive, but absolutely essential advice. The more demands made on your time, the more essential it becomes to choose what and how many things you pay attention to. You're never too busy to hyperfocus. When it comes to your most important tasks, the fewer things you pay attention to, the more productive you become. Hyperfocusing on habits. The most important aspect of hyperfocus is that only one productive or meaningful task consumes your attentional space. This is simply non-negotiable. Here's why. The most critical tasks, projects, and commitments benefit from every bit of extra attention. They're usually not habits, which by default don't often consume your full attentional space. This is not to say that it's impossible to hyperfocus on a habit. There is no task too small to consume your attention. If you tried hard enough, you could commit your complete attention to watching paint dry. But there are two reasons why this mental mode is best preserved for complex tasks rather than habits. First, hyperfocus requires willpower and mental energy to activate, drawing from the limited supply we have to make it through the day. Because habits consume so little of our attentional space, there's really no need to hyperfocus on them. Second, and more interesting, while your performance on complex tasks benefits, when you focus more completely, your habitual task performance actually suffers when you focus with your complete attention. You may have experienced this the last time you noticed someone watching you walk, and you brought your focus to making sure you walked like a perfectly normal human being. Chances are you immediately started moving like a full-blown mechanical robot, feeling as if you were flailing all over the sidewalk. To put it bluntly, your walking performance suffered. A footnote on this, effect is partially due to what in psychology circles is known as the spotlight effect, where you think everyone's watching you when really they couldn't care less. Or maybe the last time you went bowling, you found yourself thinking about why you were scoring more points than usual, what exactly you were doing well. But then your opponent started pulling ahead and eventually won. You choked. And your performance suffered by your bringing your full attention to a game you usually play, out of habit. Studies analyzing skilled typists found the same phenomenon. The more attention they brought to their typing, the slower they typed, and the more mistakes they made. When doing such habitual tasks, it's best to not focus completely on what you're doing. Save hyperfocus for your most complex tasks, things that will actually benefit from your complete attention, such as writing a report, mapping your team's budget, or having a meaningful conversation with a loved one. A few marvelous things happen when you do so. First, because you're focusing on a single task, you likely have some attentional space to spare, enough that you are also able to keep your original intention in mind. As a result, you are less likely to be derailed by distractions and interruptions because you have enough awareness to notice that they are about to derail you. And maybe most important, you have enough attention to also think deeply about the task as you work. This allows you to remember and learn more, get back on track when your mind wanders, and consider alternative approaches as you solve problems. All of this will save you an immense amount of time in completing the task. One of the best ways to get more done and done faster is by preventing yourself from focusing on things that aren't important. The four stages of hyperfocus. In any given moment, you're focused on either your external environment, the thoughts in your head, or both. Engaging solely with your external environment means you're effectively living on autopilot mode. You slip into this mode as you wait for the traffic light to change, or find yourself bouncing around a loop of the same apps on your phone. When you're engaged only with the thoughts in your head, you're daydreaming. This can happen when you go on a quick walk without your phone, your mind wanders in the shower, or you go for a jog. You enter into hyperfocus when you engage both your thoughts and your external environment and direct them at one thing intentionally. A footnote on this. In this way, hyperfocus is the state that precedes what Mihaly Csikszentmihalyi calls a flow state, the state where we're entirely absorbed in what we're doing and time passes at a much faster rate. As Csikszentmihalyi explains in Flow, when we're immersed in this state, quote, nothing else seems to matter, end quote. This is yet another reason why focusing on only one thing is essential. Our odds of experiencing flow rise exponentially when several things aren't competing for our limited attention. Hyperfocus is the process that leads to flow. So how do we enter hyperfocus mode? The science suggests we pass through four stages as we begin to focus. First, we're focused and productive. Then, assuming we don't get distracted or interrupted, our mind begins to wander. Third, we make a note of this mind wandering. This can take a while, especially if we don't frequently check what is consuming our attentional space. On average, we notice about 5 times an hour that our mind has wandered. And fourth, we shift our focus back to our original object of attention. The four stages of hyperfocus are modeled on this framework. To hyperfocus, you must 1. Choose a productive or meaningful object of attention. 2. Eliminate as many external and internal distractions as you can. 3. Focus on that chosen object of attention and 4. Continually draw your focus back to that one object of attention. Setting an intention for what we plan to focus on is the most important step. The more productive and meaningful the task, the more productive and meaningful your actions become. For example, if you set your intention to focus on mentoring a new employee, automating a repetitive task, or brainstorming a new product idea, you'll be infinitely more productive than if you work intention-free and in autopilot mode. This same idea applies at home. The more meaningful our objects of focus, the more meaningful our life becomes. We experience the benefits of hyperfocus mode by setting such simple intentions as being present in a conversation with our partner or fully enjoying a meal with our family. we learn more, remember more, and process our actions more deeply, and our lives become more meaningful as a result. This first step to reaching hyperfocus mode is essential. Intention absolutely has to precede attention. The second step to reaching hyperfocus is eliminating as many internal and external distractions as possible. There's a simple reason we fall victim to distraction. In the moment, distractions are more attractive objects of attention than what we really ought to be doing. This is true both at work and at home. Email alerts that pop into the corner of our screen are usually more tempting than the task we're doing in another window. The TV behind our partner at the pub is usually more enticing than focusing on the conversation. Distractions are infinitely easier to deal with in advance. By the time they appear, it's often already too late to defend our intention against them. Internal distractions must be tamed as well, including random and sometimes cringeworthy memories and thoughts that bubble up as we're trying to focus, the mental resistance we have to unappealing tasks like doing our taxes or cleaning the garage, and the times we want to focus but our mind wants to wander. Third, hyperfocus becomes possible when we focus on our chosen object of attention for a predetermined amount of time. This involves hunkering down for a set period that is both comfortable and feasible. The more groundwork we lay in the first two steps of hyperfocus, the more deeply and confidently we can accomplish step three. Fourth, and finally, hyperfocus is about drawing our attention back to the original object of attention when our mind wanders. I'll repeat this point frequently, as it's one of the most important ideas in this audiobook. Again, research shows that our mind wanders for 47% of the day. In other words, if we're awake for 18 hours, we're engaged in what we're doing for just 8 of them. It's normal for our mind to wander, but the key is to center it so we can spend time and attention on what's actually in front of us. In addition, it takes an average of 22 minutes to resume working on a task after we're distracted or interrupted. We fare even worse when we interrupt or distract ourselves. In these cases, it takes 29 minutes to return to working on the original task. The more often we assess what's occupying our attentional space, the quicker we're able to get back on track. Don't stress too much about this right now. We'll get to the specifics later in the audiobook. The concept of hyperfocus can be summed up in a single, tranquil sentence. Keep one important, complex object of attention in your awareness as you work. Choosing what to focus on. Attention without intention is wasted energy. Intention should always precede attention. In fact, the two ideas pair perfectly. Intention setting allows us to decide how we should spend our time. Focusing our attention on that task gets it done efficiently. The best way to become more productive is to choose what you want to accomplish before you begin working. When we set intentions, it's important to remember that not all work tasks are created equal. Some tasks enable us to accomplish an incredible amount with every minute we spend on them. These include such goals as setting aside time to plan what main tasks you want to accomplish each day, mentoring a new employee who joined your team a month ago, and writing that book you've been meaning to for years. These tasks fall into the necessary and purposeful quadrants discussed in Chapter 1. When you measure work in these quadrants against unnecessary and distracting tasks like attending useless meetings, catching up on your social media feeds, and repeatedly checking for new email, it's not hard to see which are more productive. When we don't choose which quadrants of tasks to spend time on, we fall into autopilot. This is not to say that we can't get by in autopilot mode. By being ultra-responsive to the work that comes our way, we can stay on top of most of it and probably be productive enough to not lose our jobs. But autopilot mode also fails to progress our work in any meaningful way. I suspect you don't get paid simply to play the role of traffic cop by moving emails, conversations, and instant messages around. Such tasks and answering unanticipated demands that come your way are always necessary. But whenever possible, you should take an active role in choosing where you spend your time and attention. Side note. If you haven't done so already, this is a great time to create a 2x2 grid of your work, sorting your standard monthly tasks based on whether they're productive or unproductive and attractive or unattractive. The ironic thing about investing in your productivity is that it's almost impossible to do when you're slogging it out in the office trenches. There's simply too much to keep up with, meetings, email chains, and project deadlines included. For this reason, the best productivity tactics are the ones that require you to step back and remove yourself from your work so you have the mental space to think critically about how you should approach that work differently. That way, when you return to work, you can do it more intelligently instead of just harder. Figuring out your four types of work tasks is one of those stepping back exercises. Now is the best time to do so, especially before you listen to the very next section. It'll take just 5 to 10 minutes. In researching attention and intention over the last few years, I've developed a few favorite daily intention-setting rituals. Here are my top three. 1. The rule of three. You can probably let your mind wander a bit during this section if you're familiar with the material I've written in the past. If not, allow me to introduce the rule of three. At the start of each day, choose the three things you want to have accomplished by day's end. While a to-do list is useful to capture the minutiae of the day, these three intention slots should be reserved for your most important daily tasks. I've done this little ritual every morning for several years, ever since learning about it from Microsoft's Director of Digital Transformation, J.D. Meyer. The rule of three is deceptively simple. By forcing yourself to pick just three main intentions at the start of the day, you accomplish several things. You choose what's important, but also what's not important. The constraints of this rule push you to figure out what actually matters. The rule is also flexible within the constraints of your day. If your calendar is packed with meetings, those commitments may dictate the scope of your three intentions, while an appointment-free day means you can set intentions to accomplish more important and less urgent tasks. When unexpected tasks and projects come your way, you can weigh those new responsibilities against the intentions you've originally set. Because three ideas fit comfortably within your attentional space, you can recall and remember your original intentions with relative ease. On days when your schedule is set, such as when you're attending a conference, you may not be able to determine how you spend your time and attention. You can, however, change how you relate to what you have to get done. For example, instead of making an intention to attend conference talks, opt instead to connect with 5 new people at the cocktail reception. Make sure to keep your three intentions where you can see them. I keep mine on the giant whiteboard in my office, or if I'm traveling, at the top of my daily to-do list, which is synced between devices in OneNote. If you're like me, you may also find it handy to set 3 weekly intentions as well as 3 daily personal intentions, such as disconnecting from work during dinner, visiting the gym before heading home from the office, or gathering receipts for taxes. 2. Your most consequential tasks. A second intention-setting ritual I follow is considering which items on my to-do list are the most consequential. If you have the habit of maintaining a to-do list, which I highly recommend and whose power I will discuss later in the audiobook, take a second to consider the consequences of carrying out each task, the sum of both its short-term and long-term consequences. The most important tasks on your list are the ones that lead to the greatest positive consequences. What will be different in the world, or in your work, or in your life, as a result of your spending time doing each of the items on your list? What task is the equivalent of a domino in a line of 100 that, once it topples over, initiates a chain reaction that lets you accomplish a great deal. Another way to look at this: when deciding what to do, instead of considering just the immediate consequences of an activity, also consider the second and third order consequences. For example, let's say you're deciding whether to order a funnel cake for dessert. The immediate consequence of the decision is that you enjoy eating the cake. But the second and third order consequences are a bit steeper. A second order consequence might be that you'll feel terrible for the rest of the evening. Third order consequences might include gaining weight or breaking a new diet regimen. This is a powerful idea to internalize, especially since the most important tasks are often not the ones that immediately feel the most urgent or productive. Writing a guide for new hires may not, in the moment, feel as valuable as answering a dozen emails, but if that guide cuts down the time it takes to bring each new employee on board, makes her feel welcome, and also serves to make her more productive, it's easily the most consequential thing on your list. Other consequential tasks might include automating a task that's annoying and repetitive, disconnecting so you can focus on designing the workflow for an app you're building, or forming an office mentorship program that lets employees easily share their knowledge. If you have a lot of tasks on your to-do list, ask yourself, which are the most consequential? This exercise works well in tandem with the four types of tasks in your work. Once you've separated them into the four quadrants of necessary, purposeful, distracting, and unnecessary, ask yourself, out of the necessary and purposeful tasks, which have the potential to set off a chain reaction? 3. The hourly awareness chime. Setting 3 daily intentions and prioritizing your most consequential tasks are great ways to be more intentional every day and week. But how can you ensure you're working intentionally on a moment-by-moment basis? As far as productivity is concerned, these individual moments are where the rubber meets the road. It's pointless to set goals and intentions if you don't act toward accomplishing them throughout the day. My favorite way to make sure I'm staying on track with my intentions is to frequently check what's occupying my attentional space, to reflect on whether I'm focusing on what's important and consequential, or whether I've slipped into autopilot mode. To do so, I set an hourly awareness chime. A key theme of hyperfocus is that you shouldn't be too hard on yourself when you do notice your mind drifting off or doing something else weird. Your mind will always wander, so consider how that might present an opportunity to assess how you're feeling and then set a path for what to do next. Research shows that we are more likely to catch our minds wandering when we reward ourselves for doing so. Even if you minimize one or two distractions and set one or two intentions each day, you're doing better than most. If you're anything like me, your hourly awareness chime may at first reveal that you're usually not working on something important or consequential. That's okay, and even to be expected. The important thing is that you're regularly checking what's occupying your attentional space. Set an hourly timer on your phone, smartwatch, or another device. This will easily be the most productive interruption you receive throughout the day. When your hourly chime rings, ask yourself the following: was your mind wandering when the awareness chime sounded? Are you working on autopilot or on something you intentionally chose to do? It's so satisfying to see this improve over time. Are you immersed in a productive task? If so, how long have you spent focusing on it? If it was an impressive amount of time, don't let the awareness chime trip you up. Keep going. What's the most consequential thing you could be doing right now? Are you working on it? How full is your attentional space? Is it overflowing, or do you have attention to spare? Are there distractions preventing you from hyperfocusing on your work? You don't have to answer all of these questions. Pick 2 or 3 prompts that you find the most useful, ones that will make you refocus on what's important. Doing this hourly increases all 3 measures of attention quality. It helps you focus longer because you spot and prevent distractions on the horizon. You notice more often that your mind has wandered and can refocus it. And you can, over time, spend more of your day working intentionally. When you first start this check-in, you probably won't fare so well and will find yourself frequently working on autopilot, getting distracted, and spending time on unnecessary and distracting tasks. That's fine. When you do, adjust course to work on a task that's more productive and tame whatever distractions derailed you in that moment. If you notice the same distractions frequently popping up, make a plan to deal with them. We'll get to this in the next chapter. Try setting an hourly awareness chime for one workday this week. While at first the interruptions will admittedly be annoying, they'll establish a valuable new habit. If you don't like the idea of an awareness chime, try using a few cues in your environment that trigger you to think about what's occupying your attentional space. I no longer use an hourly awareness chime, though I found it to be the most helpful method to get into the practice. Today, I reflect on what I've been working on during a few predetermined times. Each time I walk to the washroom, when I leave my desk to get water or tea, or when my phone rings. I answer the call after a few rings once I've reflected on what was occupying my attentional space. How to set stronger intentions. Over the last few decades, Peter Golwitzer has been one of the most renowned contributors to the field of intention. He's perhaps best known for his groundbreaking research on the importance of not only setting intentions, but also making them very specific. While we often achieve our vague intentions, specific intentions greatly increase our odds of overall success. Let's say, for example, you rushed to set your personal intentions this morning and came up with this list. 1. Go to the gym. 2. Quit working when I get home. And 3. Go to bed by a reasonable time. I've deliberately made these intentions vague, but how can we make them more specific and likely to stick? First, it's worth considering how effective these intentions are as I've formulated them. They will certainly prove to be more effective than doing nothing. In fact, Golwitzer's research discovered that even vague intentions like these boost your odds of successfully carrying them out by around 20% to 30%. So if you're lucky, you might cross another one or two off the list. Not bad. Setting more specific intentions, however, does something remarkable. It makes our odds of success much higher. In one study, Golwitzer and his research colleague Veronica Brandstetter asked participants to set an intention to complete a difficult goal over Christmas break, such as completing a term paper, finding a new apartment, or settling a conflict with their significant other. Some students set a vague intention, while others set what Golwitzer calls an implementation intention. As he explains the term, quote, make a very detailed plan on how you want to achieve what you want to achieve. What I'm arguing in my research is that goals need plans, ideally plans that include when, where, and which kind of action to move towards the goal, end quote. In other words, if a student's vague goal was to find an apartment during Christmas break, his implementation intention could be, I will hunt for apartments on Craigslist and email 3 apartment landlords in the weeks leading up to Christmas. Comparing Golwitzer and Brandstetter's 2 participant groups is where things get interesting. A remarkable 62% of students who set a specific implementation intention followed through on their goals. The group that did not set an implementation intention fared a lot more poorly, following through on their original intention a third as often, a paltry 22% of the time. This effect, which subsequent studies validated further, was positively staggering. Setting specific intentions can double or triple your odds of success. With that in mind, let's quickly turn my 3 vague intentions into implementation intentions. 1. Go to the gym becomes schedule and go to the gym on my lunch break. 2. Quit working when I get home is reframed as put my work phone on airplane mode and my work laptop in another room and stay disconnected for the evening. 3. Get to bed by a reasonable time becomes set a bedtime alarm for 10 p.m. and when it goes off, start winding down. Implementation intentions are powerful in much the same way as habits. When you begin a habit, your brain carries out the rest of the sequence largely on autopilot. Once you have a game plan for an implementation intention, when you encounter the environmental cue to initiate it, your lunch break rolls around, you get home after a stressful day at work, or your bedtime alarm goes off, you subconsciously get the ball rolling to accomplish your goals. Your intentions take almost no effort to initiate. As Golitzer and Bronstetter put it, quote, "Action initiation becomes swift, efficient, and does not require conscious intent," end quote. In other words, we begin to act toward our original goal automatically. Golitzer told me that the intentions do not necessarily have to be precise if they are not specific enough for a person to understand and identify the situational cues. Quote, "We did studies with tennis players, and they made plans on how they want to respond with the problems that might come up in the game. Some of the tennis players were specifying when I get irritated or when I get nervous. That is not very specific or concrete, but it worked brilliantly because they knew what they meant with nervous. Specific means the person can identify the critical situation." End quote. There are two notable caveats to setting specific intentions. First, you have to actually care about your intentions. Implementation intentions don't work nearly as well for goals that don't especially matter to you or that you've long abandoned. If you had a goal in the 1990s to amass the world's largest collection of Furbies, you'll probably be a lot less motivated to achieve that goal today. Second, easy to accomplish intentions don't have to be as specific. Deciding in advance when you'll work on a task is significantly more important for a difficult one than when your intention is to do something simple. If it's the weekend and your intention is to go to the gym at least once, you don't need to be as definitive about when you'll do so. If you're trying to accomplish something more challenging, though, like saying no to dessert at the restaurant on Saturday, setting a more specific intention is essential. That vague intention can become more specific by planning, when you see the dessert menu, to politely decline and treat yourself to a decaf coffee instead. This caveat works well for intentions at home, but when Monday rolls around, you may need to again set more thoughtful intentions. As Golitzer put it to me, quote, "When the goals are tough, or you have so many goals and it's hard to attain them all, that's when planning works particularly well," end quote. Starting a hyperfocus ritual. The next chapter focuses on taming the external and internal distractions that inevitably derail hyperfocus. However, before discussing these, I want to offer a few simple strategies to begin hyperfocusing on your intentions. These will become infinitely more powerful as you learn to tame the distractions in your work in advance. Let's first cover how to focus and then when. Both ideas are pretty simple. How to hyperfocus. Start by feeling out how long you want to hyperfocus. Have a dialogue with yourself about how resistant you feel toward the mode, particularly if you're about to hunker down on a difficult, frustrating, or unstructured task. As an example, do I feel comfortable focusing for an hour? No way. 45 minutes? Better, but still no. 30 minutes? That's doable. Okay, 25 minutes? Actually, I could probably do that. It's incredibly rewarding to experience your hyperfocus time limit increase over time. Push yourself, but not too hard. When I started practicing hyperfocus, I began with 15-minute blocks of time, each punctuated by a 5 to 10-minute distraction break. Hyperfocusing all day would be a chore, and a few stimulating distractions are always fun, especially at first. You'll soon become accustomed to working with fewer distractions. Anticipate obstacles ahead of time. If I know I have a busy few days coming up, at the beginning of the week I like to schedule my hyperfocus periods, several chunks of time throughout the week that I'll use to focus on something important. This way, I make sure to carve out time to hyperfocus instead of getting swept up in last-minute tasks and putting out proverbial fires. Such planning lets my coworkers and assistant know not to book me during these times, and it also reminds me when I'm committed to focus. In weeks like these, a few minutes of advanced planning can save hours of wasted productivity. Set a timer. I usually use my phone for this, which might sound ironic, given the distractions it can bring. If these phone distractions will cause a focus black hole, either put it on airplane mode or use a watch or other timer. Hyperfocus. When you notice that your mind has wandered or that you've gotten distracted, bring your attention back